Jacksonville's only morning local political talk show, the Ed Dean Radio Show. News, opinion, and your chance to call in with your opinion. Weekdays 6 till 9 a.m. on AM 600 WBOB. Financial issues plague us all, especially in these uncertain times. Dan Celia helps us navigate these difficult financial times every weekday from 9 till noon on AM 600 WBOB.
So much for each week's program because he had no way of knowing the questions that the listeners of that program that week were going to be asking him.
Hey, you're listening to Ask an Attorney All About Florida Law. You know that is the fun of doing live radio, by the way, because I can't really prepare for a show. I mean, I prepare every week by practicing law and talking to lots of people and their circumstances and giving the advice and so forth. So I have plenty of practice answering questions, even on the radio and in person, but I never really know what I'm going to be asked. So I can prepare generally as I practice law. I'm preparing myself to every day, learning something often in new circumstances and how to deal with them. But I can't prepare for the show. I can't prepare for your question. I haven't met you, and I don't know what you're going to ask me yet.
And that dynamic really set the radio show apart from others that you hear on a Saturday morning, because it wasn't just a program that was helping people, but it was also pretty entertaining to listen to for those that weren't calling in.
Let's go to Dinky. Is it Dinky?
Dinky.
All right. How'd you get that name?
Jinky.
Dinky. Dinky, okay. All right. Was that your birth name or is that a nickname?
Nickname. I was trying to find somebody to help me.
All right, what's your question?
My question is there any way I can sue somebody? I was sick because of allergy medication, and I lost my job, and I'm still sick until now. I've been going to doctors all the time, eye doctor. Mm-hmm. And then I wonder if there's any way I can, help to reimburse my expenses. But I went to two lawyers, but they said I cannot sue the pharmaceutical company because it's only a generic medication.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what to do. Is there any way I can?
Well, you can call me and I'll give you the name of a malpractice attorney or that, would sue in this case and maybe get a third opinion.
Yeah, I've been to lawyers, but they declined it because they said it's because it's only a generic job, generic
medicine. I don't think that's a valid reason.
Really?
Yeah, there might be a history of this particular product causing injuries to, a lot of people that have taken it.
Okay.
And I don't think just because it's generic is a defense.
Okay.
So maybe talk to one other attorney, and maybe it might be the value of the case was not worth taking. That might have been the real reason, but, I can get you somebody else to at least talk to.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
All right, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right, Dinky. All right, you have a good one.
You too.
Let's go to John in Riverview.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I got a question about the will, but I really think I need to come in and sit down for a consultation.
Well, I'd be glad to do that. Probably the closest office we have for you would probably be Sun City Center. Do you have a question, though?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and ask you. It may take a few minutes, but what I got is a brother that died 11 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
and he had a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived longer than him, and she just passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a piece of property with a trailer on it together. So in the will, he owned the property and he owned the trailer. So he left the property to me, including the trailer. But now, before she passed,
mm-hmm.
she went and bought a new trailer, and the new trailer's in her name.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to the old trailer?
The old trailer was junk.
Okay.
It went to the dump, I think.
All right. Must have been a very big dumpster.
Trailer graveyard, I suppose.
All right.
But anyways, now she had four children.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fighting me over the trailer and not wanting it. What happened is they let somebody live there. They had to put my house at the back up.
Well, the trailer would have been in her name, so it would have been in her estate.
I don't know if she made a will or not, but anyways.
But it doesn't matter. The state makes one for you if you don't make one yourself.
Okay, in the meantime, she had to be put in a nursing home. Her sons and daughters let nephews stay in that trailer, and they got up on the roof and punched holes all over the roof, and the inside of it is trash.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're telling me I've got to move the trailer off of the property.
Who is they?
Her children.
Well, their children don't have any authority over you. So you still own the land. What's the land worth?
The taxes on it's valued at $28,000.
I would write them a certified letter that they have to remove the trailer, that it belongs to them. It was in her name. And if they don't do it fairly soon, you'll treat it as abandoned property and have the county come remove it, and the county probably sell it at auction or something, or have it condemned. But they can't make you do anything. Now, where do they want you to move it?
Because it ain't no good.
No, where? Okay, so they want to abandon it?
Exactly, and I don't know where the only place it can go is in the dumpster. That's how bad it is.
Okay. Well, how much would it cost you to move it?
Probably around $5,000, from what I've heard from other people. I haven't got a price yet.
Would a scrap metal person come want it for the value of the metal or anything?
Well, I did that once before, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
These trailers today are made out of vinyl, and the only metal left on the trailer now is the frame that it sits on. So I done talked to three of them, and none of them will go get it for the metal.
I see. All right, John, when you come see me, since you said you wanted to, we can sit down and we can work out a little strategy to get rid of the property.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
So let's go to Stan. Good morning, Stan.
Good morning. I'm wondering about going through small claims court procedures when you've had an injury by a doctor during an operation.
Uh-huh. Is the value of the damages less than $5,000?
Well, yeah, because I've run out of the, practically run out of the statute of limitations, you see, and an attorney would want 6 months or more to prepare the case because of its complexity, and so a normal trial would not be appropriate. So I have to go through a small claims court by myself.
Well, sometimes an attorney can look at it and determine whether or not you have a case. And even though it might take time to prepare the case, once they file the case and get it started, then you don't have a statute of limitations problem.
Well, I guess my question is, have you had any experience with small claims court procedures like this? Because if this requires a full-blown trial with expert testimony and medical...
But see, if you can have a full-blown... The limit in small claims court is $5,000.
Right.
So, I mean, if you have a full-blown trial with medical testimony and expert witnesses and all that kind of stuff, you're going to spend more than $5,000 to get...
Well, that's what I was afraid of.
Yeah, so, I mean, it really probably wouldn't make sense.
And as far as I understand, even though you go through the small claims procedure, about the only difference between small claims and a normal civil suit is the fact that you don't have a jury in the small claims situation. In other words, can you use medical records, written medical records, as evidence in a small claims trial?
Yes, you can use whatever evidence you want.
Do you have to have oral testimony of a medical expert?
You don't have to do anything. You do whatever you best can do to present your case.
Uh-huh.
What I would do if I were you, Stan, if you want to call my office tomorrow, I can refer somebody to you that can look at this and advise you of your rights. And if they think you have a case, they would probably take it. And I don't know how much time you have to file the suit, but you know they could have if they have 2, 3, 4 weeks to look at it to determine whether or not. And a lot of times they can just determine it by talking to you at the first meeting. You know, they can then they take it to their committee and decide whether or not they want to pursue
it. Yeah, that'd be helpful.
All right, we'll just call my office tomorrow, and I'll give you a name or two.
Very good. Thank you. Your name, sir?
Joe Pippin.
Pippin. Very good. All right, I've heard of you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Vivian in Poinciana.
Yes, good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Thanks for receiving my call. I am calling to find out what recourse do I have. I co-signed for a co-worker to get a car, and the car has been repossessed. And the company called me to say that $21,700 is owing on it. And
mm-hmm. You obligated yourself on the note to buy the car?
I don't understand what you mean.
All right, there was a loan to buy the car, and you co-signed on the loan?
Yes. So now I am wanting to know if they said if they don't get that much, I have to pay the difference.
Yeah, well, they can file a lawsuit against you for the difference.
Oh, my.
Get a judgment against you. You never... hardly ever co-sign on any type of loan for anybody.
I find that out now.
Well, it's a lesson that maybe other people can learn from, but you definitely don't do it because then you become responsible, and they always go find a way to go against the person with the most money.
Okay. Oh, I thought that maybe there would be some way I could get out of that.
No, you've already signed paper. Paper is a contract. Contract has obligations, responsibilities to go with it, and they're not going to release you from that.
Okay.
So you have to deal with it the best way you can. Like Brian, contact them, tell them the circumstances, see if you can work something out.
Okay. Okay, sir. Thank you for your advice.
All right. Thank you. Okay. You're listening to Ask an Attorney All About Florida Law. I'm Attorney Joe Pippin.
And let's go to Paul in Clearwater.
Thanks for taking the call. We bought a house last year. The closing went well, no problems with it. And then as a result of pulling some permits to do some work, found out that a neighbor's wall was 3 inches on our yard. To us, it's not an issue. However, you know, everybody being an expert is, oh, you need to take care of this immediately. It's a problem. Is it a problem or not?
All right, what's the question now? You've got neighbors, Brent.
A neighbor put up a cement wall.
Yes.
And it's 3 inches on our property.
Oh.
And as a result of pulling permits, we found out after it was bought, I mean, nothing was brought at the closing table. The survey had been there. Just nothing was ever mentioned, even though it was on the survey when we bought the property. So the question is it an issue if we were to go and sell the house 5 years from now, or is it not
an issue? Well, I would say it could be an issue, you know, for sure. I think if the... concrete fence is on your property, you could have it removed. They can either buy the property from you now. I mean, you could actually sell them 3 inches down the line for X number of dollars. The longer it stays there, the more they could claim adverse possession and possibly claim the property at some point. I think you need to get things resolved in writing. You either accept it the way it is, maybe they can pay you a little bit for the money, or you could possibly make them tear down the fence.
Okay, so
on your property,
take care of it now before it is an issue.
Yeah, I would.
Okay. And you just call somebody like yourself to get that going?
Yeah, I have a real estate attorney who does nothing but real estate transactions and deals with matters like this, so I'm sure. Do you want to sell the 3 inches?
It really doesn't matter to us. We just want it to be a clear thing if we were to have to sell it someday, so.
Yeah, the longer it sits there, the more the more that advantages the other party.
So we should probably just say it came as a result of pulling this that we found out and would like to take care of it now.
Yes, I would.
Okay.
Now, let me ask you this. Let me back up just a few seconds. So when you bought the property, the fence was already on your land, correct?
Right. When we put in the purchase offer, it wasn't there.
Wasn't there.
When we actually went to the closing table,
it was there.
It was there. And on the survey that we had that we sort of looked a couple months after buying it.
The survey was done before or after the closing?
The survey was done prior to the closing, but after the wall was put up.
Oh.
And so when we pulled some permits, we said, hey, it looks like the wall is on our property. And the surveyor said, yep, 3 inches, exactly. You know, it's marked down there.
And did the survey show that?
Yes, it did show it, but nobody...
Nobody noted or made a special issue out of it.
Right.
And well, that's interesting.
Not being able to read surveys, I called a surveyor directly and just said, you know, can I just ask you, is it truly on or not? And he said, oh, yeah, it's on. So, but he
and you were represented at
lawyer.
You were represented at closing by a realtor and an attorney?
Correct.
I see.
So I think it just got
Did passed. The attorney write the title insurance?
I'd have to look up the title insurance.
Yeah, there could possibly be a claim against the title company.
Okay.
Because they gave you a title policy, which is a warranty and a warranty deed.
Right, and we have that.
Guaranteed by the title policy that you have free and clear title to the whole property. And you actually don't.
And we have their certificate, the deed, the booklet, everything all together that was put together by our real estate agent, who's been wonderful.
Well, you might go back to your attorney that did help you at the closing.
Okay.
And say, look, I paid for title insurance for free and clear title, and here's the problem with the fence on my property. And it seems to me the attorney or the title company should have, that I paid to help me assist to get a free and clear title on the whole property during the closing. Somebody dropped the ball on this. Well, what do you think, and what should I do? And ask the attorney that was involved in the closing to start with to help you.
Great.
All right?
All right. Well, that sounds good. Thank you so much for your help.
All right. No problem. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. You're listening to Ask an Attorney All About Florida Law. Let's go to Haines City, Florida, and talk to Janet.
My question is, I was at my son's house last week, and my grandson was playing in their backyard with a few friends,
mm-hmm.
and the ball went into the neighbor's yard. Now, the neighbor has told him before that he doesn't want the kids out back playing ball.
Mm-hmm. Out back in a yard that's not his.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And we got the ball returned by the police because he called the police on them. My question is, what recourse does he have if my grandson does play ball in the backyard and his ball does go into his yard?
But it doesn't do any damage.
It didn't do any damage. It just bounced off their fence and landed in his yard.
Mm-hmm. What recourse does he have against you or the kids?
Right.
Well, I don't think he has much of anything if there's no damage done.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. I can't think of a cause of action. I mean, there could be a trespass, but that's really a stretch in the law to have a ball be, you know, a trespass violation.
Right, and the kids know not to try to go into the yard to get it.
These are 8 and 9 years
old. They're 8 and 9 year old kids.
Okay, so they lose their ball.
Yeah.
And he's got a ball he doesn't want. So, I mean, I don't know. I can't think of a cause of action the guy would have.
Okay, other than just calling the cops repeatedly, right?
That's it.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know.
Yeah, maybe so we have some other listener out there who's gone through this and there has been some cause of action of some type, and if they want to call in, you can keep listening, and I'd be glad to give them the microphone.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right. So we've got the ball in the neighbor's yard and the mattress in the canal questions today. It's really a hot show. You're listening to Ask an Attorney All About Florida Law. I'm not making light of anybody's question. I mean, these are all, when you have a question in your mind, you know, you want an answer. And that is your right here. And that's why I'm here, to help you and give you peace of mind. And I'm glad to do that. I've had some questions in the past, like, what can a movie theater do to me if I take my own candy in my pocketbook or purse to the movie theater and they catch me? You know, I've had questions like that. One of my all-time favorite questions, I guess, in this area of questions is a man called and wanted the gold out of his mother's teeth, and the funeral director wouldn't oblige him, and he wanted to know his rights that he had after his mother died to get the gold out of her teeth. I've had some great questions, and I really enjoy them and enjoy helping people.
And certainly that enjoyment was easy to hear every week during the Ask an Attorney program, all about Florida law. If you're just joining us here today, it's a tribute program to the life of Joe Pippin, and we've been listening to various caller conversations he had over the radio program over the many years, almost 40 years that the program was on in the Tampa Bay area and all across Florida. And while often the calls were on a variety of topics, as we've heard so far today, the one area where there was never any ambiguity was in the field of wills, trusts, and probate, his area of expertise.
What is a living trust? The most often asked question I get every week on my radio show probably is, what is a living trust? All a living trust is a fancy will. A lot of people think it's something else, but that's really all it is. It's a fancy will with some special features. The first special feature of a living trust is that it avoids probate. If you have a will, it's going to go through probate. If you have a trust, it's not. You have chosen to avoid probate through the use of a living trust. With a will, your assets take often 6 to 14 months to go through probate. With a trust, since you've avoided probate, you've chosen a very fast distribution process, very much unlike probate. If you have a will, you've only planned for death. Wills do not deal with if you become incapacitated. If you have a living trust, you and your attorney have designed a guardianship plan built into the document. If you have a will, it becomes a public document upon death. With a trust, it can be a private affair, so no one knows what's going on in your estate, who gets what, and so forth. So a living trust has four big advantages over a will. It avoids probate. It makes easy, fast, and quick distribution of the estate upon death. It gives you a guardianship plan, and it arranges for privacy of your estate. For more information about this and many more legal subjects, join me, Attorney Joe Pippin, for Ask an Attorney. Now, if a client comes in talking about the definition of a trust, at the same time, I think you should tell them about a will and maybe some of the disadvantages of just having a will. You tell them the cost of probate. You tell them the time, and quote, your fee. I think if a client came in and said, give me something in writing as to what your probate fee would be, I think that'd be a pretty sharp client, actually, to get the idea and something from you in writing about what your fee's going to be to handle the estate one day. Because we all know attorney fees vary from one attorney to another a great deal on probate. Tell them how long it's going to take to probate. Tell them about the 90-day period in the notice of administration, and most probates take at least 6 months, maybe sometimes up to a year. Tell them that they need a guardianship plan. You know, 50% of Americans become incapacitated before they die. 50% of Americans need someone with either a power attorney or some other instrument to do things for them, and tell them that they want to plan for that, or they want to leave it in the hands of the guardianship court to make decisions, or do they want to be the boss? Do they want to plan it? You need to discuss all of these things. You need to discuss the privacy feature of wills versus trust. All of these things, I think, are important in estate planning for the client to have a good understanding of the differences that they have, the choices that they have. Now, I know people from the radio shows that I do, I know people are confused about wills and trust and probate. I had a lady not too long ago call in and wanted to know if she could probate her own will. And I went on to explain to her that probate didn't take place until after death, and she still didn't understand the answer. So people have misunderstandings about all these things. I had a lady in my office 2 weeks ago that said, well, I solved the probate problem. My will's not going to go through probate. I tore it up. I have people come in and say that. They'll ask questions like that on the radio. They'll come in and make comments about that. There's a big misunderstanding about estate planning, and I think your choice is to tell them what a trust is, to describe how it works, to tell them the difference between having a will and having a trust. And that is basically your job. If you're in estate planning, that's what you need to do. That's what I think.
All right, let's go to Eddie in Tampa.
Hi there, Joe.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. I have a question. Can you explain the basic difference between a trust and a power of attorney, please?
Well, sure. A living trust is just a fancy will. A living trust or a will are going to have instructions about who's going to take over upon death and pay the bills and make the distribution according to your instructions. Power of attorney is so someone has the power. Our power of attorney right now has 106 different powers, and the powers are of anything you could do. There's a power listed for someone else to do of your choice to be able to help you if you can't do it. And the power of attorney, unlike a will and trust, kick into effect upon death. Power of attorney kicks in to effect as soon as you sign it and is void upon death. And the power of attorney, of course, doesn't have any distribution language. It doesn't have any instructions on what to do with assets upon death.
Got it. Okay. All right, Jerome. Thank you very much.
All right.
Have an awesome day.
Yeah, do you have a will or a trust? Do you have a will or a trust?
Actually, I have a will, and I also have a power of attorney executed.
Okay. Well,
I was just wondering.
Yeah, your will take place upon death, your instructions, and your power of attorney gives them someone the power to act on your behalf while you're living. Power of attorney should be updated, by the way, about every 3 or 4 years to keep current dates on them.
Really?
Yes, ma'am.
I have updated. Okie dokie, sir. I appreciate your answers.
All right, thanks, Addie. Thanks for calling.
Day.
All right, you too. All right, let's go to Charlie calling. Yes, Charlie, what can I do for you?
My question is, I have a living will with my three kids.
You have a living trust?
A living will. A living trust, I'm sorry, yeah. Not a living trust, no. What do you call them?
The last will and testament?
The last will and testament, right.
Okay.
With the percentage or the separation of the property. Now, somebody advised me to register the property with the life estate in the same way to the county.
Yeah, you can do a ladybird deed or a life estate deed. You can do that.
So this way they don't have to go to probate. Am I right?
Yes, you can do it that way. I usually, when I'm discussing this with clients, we can discuss that if they have a question about it. I do think a living trust is a better way to plan because with a living trust, you can the successor trustee can deal with the property better while you're living. Whereas a life estate deed, nothing really happens until you pass away on the transfer, but things might need to be done while you're living for your benefit.
I see. But, I mean, for a home state, it doesn't change if I do that, right?
No. Either way, there's no change in the homestead status.
Good enough. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Charlie. All right, let's go to Winifred in Bradenton.
Hello?
Yes. What can I do for you?
Yes. I have a will, which I made probably 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
where my oldest daughter and my youngest daughter are both executors on the will. But my oldest daughter died in December, and so I know she would. I'm leaving my estate to my children.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering, what is the simplest way to make her son, since he's like a son to me, make her husband part of my will? What is the simplest way to do that?
Well, just do a new, either do a codicil to the will or a new will. We charge the same thing for a codicil or a new will, which is like $125.
Okay.
So we just do a new document that names whoever you want to be as your beneficiary. If you want to name your deceased daughter's, I'm very sorry about your daughter, but if you want to name your deceased daughter's husband as a beneficiary, then you just have to either change the existing document or do a new document.
Okay.
If you came to me, for example, during that conversation, you know, I'd be glad to do a new will for you, but I'd also want to discuss with you the advantages you might have in considering a living trust to avoid probate. If you didn't,
I don't know whether I would have to.
Well, it was just.
Isn't there a dollar amount that you have to reach to go to probate or?
Not really, because any size estate goes through probate, and the minimum probate fee is like $2,500 that we charge. and there's about a $600 or $700 out of pocket cost. So, you know, you're into over $3,000 to do a probate even on a very small estate. And you can avoid that with a trust. And we have a package fee, flat fee for trust packages like $695. And that includes the trust, the deed, the power of attorney, the living will, health care surrogate living will. You get a whole new package of all the documents you need for the flat fee.
For the flat fee of what, $695?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, that sounds like that's a better way to go.
Well, that's what most of my clients do. Maybe not everybody, but that's what most of my clients do, too. It's just a fancy will that avoids probate.
Okay. Okay. Well, that sounds very good. Do you have offices here in Bradenton?
I have offices in Sun City Center, which most of my Bradenton clients come there. We have office also in Lakewood Ranch, but I don't go to that office, but I do have another very experienced attorney that goes to that office.
Okay, and their fees are the same?
Yes.
Bye now.
Let's go to Rick calling from Florida. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Joe. Good morning.
Rick, what city are you calling from?
I actually live in Stuart, Florida.
All right. What can we do for you?
Well, I wanted to... Lady Bird gave my primary residence to my son, who's my only heir, and to basically remove the asset from my name and avoid probate, if, you know, when I expire.
Okay.
And my only question is, in doing so, am I able to change that, or say if I wanted to, you know, 5 years from now, you know, roll it back into my name or put it into a trust?
Yeah, I had a conversation with a client exactly along these lines yesterday, and here's what I told the client. Yes, you can do a ladybird deed. Yes, you can name your son as the beneficiary of your property on the deed. Yes, you can change the deed at any time. You could cancel that deed or change that deed and name someone else, or you can do whatever you want to do. You could sell the property before you die. You can do whatever you want to do with the ladybird deed, and the ladybird deed does avoid probate. Is there perhaps an alternative and a better way to do this? And my answer is yes. I would prefer, me, I would not do a ladybird deed. I would do a living trust, put the property into a living trust. You can always amend or change the trust. The trust has a beneficiary. The better part to me is that if I have a stroke or become incapacitated, that the successor trustee that I choose can now come in, take over, and manage that property and do whatever is needed to be done with it while I'm living. A ladybird deed, nothing really happens until you die.
Question.
Yes.
As far as, say, when I get older and I want to qualify for government benefits, if I put it in a living trust, does that actually, is that considered an asset in my name?
The homestead in Florida is a non-countable asset. So the homestead does not count as an asset at all, and it's protected from creditors. So the homestead has really no impact on qualifying for Medicaid. If all you had was a homestead, you would qualify for Medicaid. The house could still be left to your son, free from the claims
right.
of the nursing home or medical
bills. What about a, Joe, what about a second home, like if I had an investment property?
A second home can also be treated as exempt if it's a rental home or perhaps it's in another state and you put the home up for sale. There's a way that we can orchestrate around also protecting the second home in Medicaid planning. I have a full-time Medicaid attorney on staff. That's all he does is Medicaid. He probably works 50, 60 hours a week helping people reposition assets, qualify for Medicaid. We can usually qualify a person for Medicaid in maybe 60 days, you know, and move assets around. The power of attorneys that we do authorize the movement into non-countable exempt categories. And also, he and I have written a little book on asset protection in Medicaid. If anyone wants that, it's $20, and they can send in for it. And I'll give out my contact information several times during the show.
Great. Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Okay. This whole idea came about because of divorce in my life. And the simplest way to quiet claim the properties into my name was my doing a ladybird deed on both the primary homestead property and the income property.
So your wife signed a deed to you?
Correct.
But it's a ladybird deed?
Right. Yeah, correct. I want to have her sign the Lady Bird deed into, and you know, quiet claim and lady into.
Well,
lady
no,
Bird
would
deed
just be a
properties.
Quick. Yeah, it would just be a quit claim deed from her to you, though.
Correct.
When a Lady Bird deed doesn't really come into that transfer during a divorce, usually.
Well, it would be. I would probably quit claim it and then Lady Bird it.
Or consider putting it in a trust. I would suggest you at least consider right. that and have a conversation with an attorney about that.
There you go. Thank you, Joe, for your time.
All right. Thank you.
And indeed, Joe Pippin was always so generous with his time, as we've heard here this morning. A small sample of the many caller interactions he had over an almost 40-year radio career, as today we pay tribute to the life of Joe Pippin on the radio. And this next piece was actually a special presentation that was done all the way back in 2006. It was a deviation from the regular format that we've been hearing so far today, which is the callers bringing the questions to him and then him being able to answer their questions either directly, particularly in the area of wills, trust, probate, but, you know, outside of that as well. But this episode was special in the sense that instead of answering the questions over the phone, this was answering questions that people had emailed him. And joining him on his broadcast was his wife, Beverly. And so here is a sample of what that program sounded like.
Hello, everyone. It's Ask an Attorney All About Florida Law. I'm Attorney Joe Pippin. Welcome to the show. This is a special show today. For the first time in 22 years, I have my wife in as a co-host. And she said that if Dr. Phil's wife can come in and help him, that she's going to come help me once. So welcome to the show, Beverly.
Thank you, Joe.
All right. We've been married for 37 years and have a couple of kids, and she's really helped me a lot in my legal career. So it's really great to have her here today. And Beverly, what's the first question?
All right. It's from Henry from Haines City. He is asking, why does my will have to go through probate? It already leaves everything to my son.
Well, you know, a lot of people ask me that question, and I like to give a little example in my answer to that question. And the answer is that when you die with a will and you die with something in your name, the asset's in the name of a deceased person. And if the asset is in the name of a deceased person, the only way you can get it out is with a court order. That whole process is called probate. The example I like to give, I had this question just the other day also when I was speaking at a seminar. And I said, listen, if you die and your son takes your will to the bank, and there's a bank account in your name and now you're deceased, and your son takes it to the bank and says, bank, here's my dad's will. Here's the death certificate. Here's my ID. You can see the will leaves everything to me. Give me the money. Is the bank going to do that? And the man says, well, yeah. I was speaking at a group of about 300 people, and I said, okay, well, let me ask this. How many people in the room of the 300 people think the bank's going to give the money? And nobody raised their hand. This man was just very headstrong in the fact that the bank should give him the money because his dad left it to him in a will and says that. And so I said, listen, sir, I said, you could come to my office today to make a will, and you could leave everything to your son. You could come to my office next week and make another will that leaves everything to your girlfriend. Now, I kind of made a mistake because the man was sitting next to his wife, but his question was, could his son, if he left everything to his son? So we kind of played with that a little bit and had some fun with it. But he realized that his son could not get the money from the bank and they wouldn't release it. So just because you leave everything in a will, your will upon death goes through probate. And the reason why is because it's in the name of a deceased person.
Okay. Susan from Largo wants to know, I want to omit one of my children from receiving anything. Can she contest my will?
Well, unfortunately, anybody can sue anybody, and anybody can contest anything. So a child has a right to contest the will, and they might say they were forgotten. Usually in a will, I'll put language that I've omitted so-and-so for personal reasons. It's hard to contest that. A lot of people come in, and they want to actually name a reason. They want to have a reason. I'm omitting my daughter because I already gave her money, or they have some reason they have, and that reason can be contested. So I just say, usually, yes, you can omit people. You just say, I've omitted them for personal reasons, so they have the right to contest, yes. The most common reasons to contest a will, number one is undue influence. Number two is incompetence. Undue influence is a big issue people don't think about. probably not a week goes by that people don't come to my office and they bring in mother or father with them. Mother or father might be slightly incapacitated, incompetent, early stages of Alzheimer's or something. A lot of times the child will start talking, and the child will try to dictate the terms of what the parent's trying to do. And if it favors that child at all, then I just stop the proceeding and say, look, parent has to come back by themselves. You can't be here. This favors you. I don't want to hear anymore. This wouldn't work in court. Somebody can contest this and win. It's undue influence. So you can do it, but be very careful. And when you go to the attorney's office, you don't go with an interested party that's going to benefit more. So that's the answer.
Okay, good. This is from Joe from Sun City Center. My wife is going into a nursing home, and the bill is $6,000 a month. What assets will I be able to keep?
Well, you know, that's a common question we get all the time is, what can we do to get government benefits? And when you're paying $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a month, we see sometimes it doesn't take long for the estate to disappear very quickly. So there are several ways to look at this situation. One is, can an attorney rearrange assets, get them all set up in proper columns so that the assets are all exempt, therefore the spouse in this case could qualify for Medicaid? Well, one of my attorneys does that all. That's his. That's what he's chosen to do, is help people get government benefits. So what he does is he knows the state of Florida has created by statute many exempt categories and exempt assets. And what he does is just help people rearrange their assets to get them all in those exempt categories so they qualify for Medicaid. So, for example, a spouse that's in the community, we'll call that person the community spouse, in this case the husband, his home is exempt regardless of the value. He also can keep $99,000 plus a car and plus prepaid funeral expenses and a few other small things like that he can keep that are non-countable. The rest of the assets are countable and would normally disqualify the wife. So what we do is to take all those assets that are countable that would disqualify the spouse, and we put them in either a special category. One special category is a Medicaid annuity. One is a personal service contract. So there are various things that we can do. We could pay down the home so that the cash in the mortgage account is that's countable otherwise would be non-countable. We can prepay things. We can do funeral accounts. We can do create special needs contracts. We can do lots of different things so the spouse can automatically qualify for Medicaid, thereby preserving the estate for the community spouse and other family members.
Okay, Judy from Lakeland wants to know, my children are spendthrifts and wasteful with money. What can I do to prevent them from spending inheritance too quickly?
Well, a lot of people have that concern, unfortunately, and a lot of it takes some children longer to grow up than others. So what we do is we talk about that to see how old the children are, and again, I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because I can't ask her how old the children are. What I would do with a minor child most often is suggest when you have a 10 or 12-year-old, for example, you don't know how they're going to turn out, how responsible they're going to be, what type of jobs they're going to have, what type of citizens they're going to be in the community. How wise they with money, none of those things you know really at 10 or 12. You might have a clue, but you don't really know for sure. So normally with a 10 or 12-year-old, what we would do is to suggest something like give them income starting at 21, give them a third of the principal at 25, give them the other half of the principal at 35, and the balance of the principal at 45. You give the trustee tremendous discretion during that time period to be able to spend money for college, education, maintenance, well-being, cost of living, just normal living things. You give the trustee discretion to pay for all of those. So you have a good plan for, and then if they're 10 or 12 now, and you can take a look every 3 or 4 years and you can modify the time periods as much as you want. If you have adult children that are 25, 30, 35, and you see that they're wasteful, not productive, not earning money, and the money they do get, they're wasteful and don't use it wisely, and you don't want your inheritance to go along those same lines, then what you can do is to just spread it out, like in an early example I gave with the spendthrift. So you could say, you could pick a time period, depending on the size of your estate. And the time period could be, I want to give it over 20 years. I give them 1/20th, 1/19th, 1/18th, 1/17th, 1/16th, and just spread out their distribution over a 20-year period. Some people give them income only on the larger estates until they get to be 60 and then start the 20-year period at 60 on the principal. It really just depends on the circumstances on this case, and if this person was in my office, I would ask them a series of questions, and we could probably nail down the perfect plan for them. Yeah, but right now, it's just too many unknowns to give the general information that I just gave, so I hope that was helpful.
And being helpful has been the hallmark of the Ask an Attorney program. There, we just had a chance to hear some excerpts from the email show that he did with his wife, Beverly, all the way back in 2006. And it would be impossible to play every interaction he had and every caller answer over the course of almost 40 years on the radio. And as we close out this tribute program, one more caller with a unique set of challenges that Joe handled in his usual patient manner.
Let's go to Lynn's in Clearwater.
Hello, good morning, sir.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you for taking the call. Here's the thing. If you have somebody in your home that you're living with, but really not living with, they're just a boarder, and they are taken to court for something their dog did, their dog bit another dog,
mm-hmm.
And then they have your name on the suit to come to call small claims court, but you're not really living with this person, they're just really a boarder, are you responsible under the Florida statutes for their liabilities and expenses? It's probably a bit muddy, that, but...
Well, if you didn't own the dog...
No, it's not my dog. It's nothing to do with me, but the dog was living in my house with this person. And really, separate bedrooms, wasn't really living with the person. Just more or less a boarder. But the thing is, the court, the thing that's come from court has my name on it, as well as the other person.
Well, actually, if you've been served papers, you're going to have to go to court and defend yourself.
Right.
Your defense would be that it's not your dog.
Right.
And I think an attorney would probably have to see how the lawsuit, what the lawsuit...
It's a small claims court.
Yeah, but you were served papers, and there's words in those in that petition against you, so an attorney would have to review what that petition says to see what your defense would be.
I see.
I mean, the petition might even state that it's your dog. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's not.
I know. So
registered with the...
Right, so you would go defend yourself and prove that it's not your dog. And then if that's what all the petition states, that was your dog, and that dog did damage to another dog, then you defend yourself simply by saying it's not your dog, which then the petition is not true. So you could easily prove that.
Yes. Now, if there was some liability against this other person, would I be responsible for that because they were living in my home?
Again, an attorney was going to have to review the petition to see what you're charged with.
I see, yeah.
You know, it's all based on what the petition says.
Yeah, well, it's a small claims court. The lady is a very old lady, and she said this dog bit her dog, and it was in a dog park where it says you enter at your own risk.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sign on the dog park. It says enter, dogs enter.
All right, so the injury didn't even happen on your property?
No.
Okay. Well, if you didn't own the dog and the injury didn't happen on your property, I can't see really where you'd have any liability. But again, an attorney would have to see what the petition says.
I see.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank
I
you.
I love your program.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
Again, we thank you for joining us today for this tribute to a great friend who we'll dearly miss, Brother Joe Pippin. If you'd like to learn more about his life or hear some audio archives of his many programs over the years, go to the website, attypip.com. Again, that's attypip.com. Have a wonderful day.
The proceeding is sponsored by the Law Offices of Joe Pippin. Learn more by visiting attypip.com.